Good afternoon. I'm Stephen Mize. I'm an archivist here at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. This month marks the publication of Advocate for the Doomed, the diaries and papers of James Grover MacDonald, 1932 to 1935. Mr. MacDonald was an American diplomat. He was born in Coldwater, Ohio, and educated at the University of Indiana and at Harvard University. Like many of his generation, he was profoundly disturbed by the events of the First World War. He felt that America had an extraordinarily reactive foreign policy, and as a result was drawn into the European theater. As a result, he, along with others, formed the Foreign Policy Association, which used the then new technology of radio to reach out to the American public and explain to them on a weekly radio program why it was important for America to have an active foreign policy. Subsequently, he served as League of Nations High Commissioner for Refugees after the Nazi ascendancy. In that capacity, he met face to face with Adolf Hitler, President Roosevelt, Mussolini, the Pope, the Rothschilds, and many others who he attempted to press into service to end what he saw as the impending tragedy of the Holocaust. He would eventually resign in frustration in 1935, owing to what he believed was collective world indifference to the plight of European Jewry. Subsequent to that, he served as President Roosevelt's advisor and chairman of the President's Committee on Refugees. He had a weekly radio program with NBC Radio, and was also on the New York Times editorial staff. He also served as U.S. diplomatic representative to the Avignon Conference and was appointed by President Truman, America's first ambassador to the new state of Israel. Like so many of the treasures at the Holocaust Museum, the diaries of James Grover MacDonald came to the museum by unsolicited donation. In May of 2003, a Washington, D.C. lawyer was cleaning out her basement. In the process of cleaning out her basement, she found amongst her father's papers a small fragment of James Grover MacDonald's diaries. Here's what had happened. Her father was a professional writer. Mr. MacDonald, when he ended his term as U.S. ambassador to Israel, wanted to write his memoirs about the founding of the new state of Israel. Not apparently confident in his skills as a writer, he began to search for ghostwriters. Her father was one of the men who he approached. He asked Mr. MacDonald for a sample of his writing. Mr. MacDonald obliged with a small sample of his diary. 60 years on, it was mixed up in this gentleman's papers, and she found it in her basement. Not knowing what to do with it, she walked the few blocks down to the Holocaust Museum and turned it over to us. They eventually found their way to my desk, and I began the process of cataloging them for the scholars to use. I came across an entry of January 1935. It dealt with the Tsar plebiscite, the Roman Catholic Church, Mexico, and the United States government. I sensed that it was important. I am an archivist, not a historian. I took the fragment up to Dr. Suzanne Brown Fleming, our expert on Judeo-Catholic relations, and showed it to her, pointing out the entry. Suffice to say that Suzanne's response made it abundantly clear that we were dealing with something of the first order of historical importance. We then went in search for the remainder of the diary, as the diary began in the middle of a day in 1934 and ended in the middle of a day in 1936. We began at Columbia University, which then took us to the United States Naval Academy, to NBC Television Archives in New York, to the Syracuse University Archives, the National Archives and Record Administration, and the Library of Congress, and other locations that eventually led to the home of Dr. Barbara MacDonald Stewart, Mr. MacDonald's youngest daughter. She invited us over to obtain the remainder of the diaries. I was very much hoping, with Museum Chief Archivist Henry Mayer, to find the balance of 1934 and 1936. Henry and I went to Bobby's house and found not only the balance of 1934 and 1936, but some 10,000 pages of diaries, letters, and documents starting from 1924 and going to 1951. Needless to say, we were extraordinarily happy. We transferred the documents to the Holocaust Museum and informed Museum Director Sarah Jane Bloomfield as to what we had found. Sarah asked Museum Historian Severin Hochberg and myself to describe what we had found. She made it clear that James Grover MacDonald was a museum priority. She equally made it clear that she wanted an elite group of historians assembled to take on the Herculean task of editing and publishing James Gover MacDonald's diaries for consumption. Thus, our panelists. To my left is Professor Richard Brightman, professor of history at the American University. He is also editor-in-chief of the Holocaust and Genocide Studies and author of American Refugee Policy and European Jewry, 1933 to 1954. He will be talking about the early years of the Nazi regime in the MacDonald Papers. In the middle is Dr. Severin Hopberg, historian for the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies at the Holocaust Museum. We'll be speaking about James Gover MacDonald and the Vatican, a case study in strategy. And finally, Dr. Barbara MacDonald Stewart, former lecturer in history at George Mason University and author of United States Government Policy on Refugees from Nazism, 1933 to 1940. She will be talking about reflections on the righteous, personal characteristics of James G. MacDonald as evidenced in his diaries. Furthermore, an interesting historical note. When President Truman appointed James Gover MacDonald U.S. Ambassador to the State of Israel, there was a crisis, a health crisis in the MacDonald family. Mr. MacDonald's wife stayed home. This presented a big problem for James Gover MacDonald. Israel was a new state. There was not yet an American embassy. He could not conduct a U.S. foreign policy as well as set up a brand new U.S. American embassy without assistance. He asked his daughter, who had just graduated from Northwestern University, to escort him to the new state of Israel and serve as U.S. diplomatic escort to the American mission. She was 21 years old. She was effectively America's first lady to Israel. There will be questions and answers after following the presentations. And for those who are interested, the book will be available for sale, and our panelists have agreed to stay around and sign if you would like your copy signed. This presentation is being made possible by the Museum Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies, which promotes the growth of this scholarly field and strives to facilitate the training of future generations of scholars specializing in the Holocaust. The center provides a fertile atmosphere for scholarly discourse and debate through research, publications, conferences, fellowships, and visiting scholar opportunities, as well as a network of cooperative programs with universities and other institutions in the United States and abroad. Materials about the center and the museum's exhibitions, programs, and activities are available in the foyer outside the auditorium. With that, Professor Brightman.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of you for coming out or in on a nice Friday afternoon. And I'd also like to start by saying what a great pleasure it has been to work with the people at this table and also with Benton Arnovitz, head of academic publications at the center, who's in the front row over there. When a book goes into production, publishers generally ask authors, or in this case, editors, to fill out a questionnaire. They call it a biographical questionnaire, but it's usually a lot more than that. In fact, it's often considered a pain in the neck. One of the questions that Indiana University Press asked us was, what other book or books is this like? And my response was immediate and instantaneous. There is no other book like this. No one else in the world was able to talk frankly with Hitler, Roosevelt, Cardinal Pacelli, Chaim Weizmann, Mussolini, the Warburg family, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, high State Department officials, British government officials, League of Nations officials, the heads of two South American governments, and many, many others. And was known to history, but not well known to history. And he wrote it all down. So I told him it was like no other work. But weeks later, I had something nagging me in the back of my mind, and eventually I figured out something? What other book is it like? What did it remind me of? And the thought that finally came to me was, it reminds me a bit of Gerhard Weinberg's now famous study, The Foreign Policy of Hitler's Germany, Diplomatic Revolution in Europe, 1933 to 1936. It covered much of the same period. Of course, it was very different in style and format. This is a diary, not a work of scholarship. But MacDonald and Weinberg were both very interested in Nazi policies against the Jews and in European diplomacy generally. And MacDonald could have read Weinberg's prize-winning study and remarked, yes, that was the Germany I knew. And Weinberg today, now retired, can read this book and find support for what he established through decades of painstaking research, plus find a lot of things that are new that only someone who was there could have added. So this book supplies, among many other things, a bird's eye view of the Nazi Revolution and its impact on German Jews. And it was written down at the time. MacDonald visited Germany repeatedly, five times in the course of the years covered in this work. More trips later, but you'll have to wait perhaps a couple of years for the second volume to see the later trips. And he was, in effect, a kind of gifted amateur at gathering political intelligence. He had unusual assets. He had the reputation of being pro-German. His family was partly of German background. He had the German language. He had good contacts in the German government before the Nazis came to power. And he had one key contact in the early Nazi regime, a man up there by the name of Putzi Hamstengel, whom he had met at Harvard, part German, part American. Hamstengel was Hitler's foreign press secretary. So when MacDonald went to Germany in March 1933, literally weeks after Hitler became chancellor, Hamstengel met with him and then got him a private appointment with the Führer. On March 29, 1933, MacDonald heard Hamstengel declare over a dinner that Germany could deal with 600,000 Jews in a single night. He wrote, in effect, perhaps he means just arrests, but he must have feared or sensed the worst, because when he came back to the United States, he subsequently predicted to Walter Lippmann, one of the eminent journalists of the era, that if the Poles and the French attacked Germany, the immediate consequence might well be a slaughter of all German Jews. The theory behind this remark was that the Nazis viewed Jews as so corrosive that they would have to be excised in case of war. And a little over a week later, MacDonald met with Hitler. In taking on the Jews, Hitler claimed Germany was fighting the interest of the world. And then MacDonald stopped dictating. He wrote or said, et cetera, et cetera. Was it because he had heard the same thing before? Perhaps. But it was more likely that he was using a German stenographer, and he was not at all sure how much he should be writing down in those chaotic weeks of the early Nazi revolution. He had been made aware that his cables and telephone conversations were being supervised. But when he returned to the United States, he met with a small group of American Jews and others whom he trusted, and told them in May 1933 what may have been Hitler's acrid conclusion. MacDonald quoting Hitler, "The world does not know how to get rid of the Jews. I will show them." Hitler's comment left many options open. There were, of course, possibilities of letting Jews leave, forcing them out, perhaps others. But Hitler's assumption that the world would benefit from the elimination of the Jews also suggested the most extreme possibility, which we know later materialized. Both contemporary sources and MacDonald's recollections indicate that in 1933, MacDonald recognized the worst case. MacDonald recorded in his diary repeatedly how his friends among German Jews, particularly Max Warburg and his son Erich, Lola Hahn, Wilfred Israel, and others, perceived an increasingly dire future in Germany and how they sought through various ways and means to promote emigration. Emigration. Well, the common view these days is that in the early years, Nazi policy had a policy of emigration for Jews. This book calls that received wisdom into question. There was one clear policy of emigration, that to Palestine. And the reason that the Nazi regime supported that arrangement was because there was a financial benefit to it. There was a way of structuring things so that it increased German exports. But in other respects, MacDonald's multiple entries indicate how difficult it was both to get Jews out of Germany and to find places willing to take them. There is another book of scholarship that I want to make reference to, a book by a colleague, Carl Schleunis, called, published in 1970, if I remember correctly, called The Twisted Road to Auschwitz. This was a very good book, especially given when it was written. It was based largely on German government, Nazi Party records. And it traced the course, the various initiatives which Nazi Germany took from 1933 on before turning to genocide. Schleunis's conclusion has often been extended, I think, oversimplified or distorted into the notion that Nazi Germany really preferred to have Jews leave and only turned into harsher measures when others wouldn't take them in. But MacDonald's diary shows that the Nazi impulse to punish and kill Jews was there from the start, even if it could not be realized in 1933. Tellingly, Hitler and those close to him would have nothing to do with MacDonald's mission once he became High Commissioner for Refugees under the League of Nations. And when McDonald proposed that there might be a way to work out a kind of grand deal, have hundreds of thousands of Jews leave Germany, provided, of course, that the German government would agree not to persecute those who remained. Hitler had no interest, and neither did other high Nazi officials. The only one who showed significant interest in this offer was the non-Nazi foreign minister, Baron von Neurath. What other features of the Nazi regime are revealed in this book? McDonald sensed very early that Nazi Germany was determined not just to revise the Treaty of Versailles, but to head towards war, and not a small war. In 1939, not in the period of this book, he gave a speech in which he said, among other things, "I'm not going to tell you that I was a prophet. I wasn't. I was merely a pessimist. It seemed to me from the very beginning of Hitler's rise to power that sooner or later a clash was inevitable. I sensed the dynamic revolutionary driving force of this new regime. I first came into contact with it in the fall of 1932, before Hitler was in power. I heard Hitler speak in September 1932, saw his regime at close range in April 1933, the fall of 1933, and repeatedly during 1934 and 1935. I could never understand during those days why everybody didn't feel this dynamic force at work within the Reich. It didn't seem to me that it required any particular intelligence to conclude that at some point this expanding power would come into conflict with the nations of Western Europe, that at some point Britain and France would have to fight." His diary sustains that view. He did not believe that Nazi Germany was going to collapse from economic problems. He did not believe that Hitler was going to be overthrown. He saw public support of the regime as very broad, and he saw almost as broad support for early Nazi anti-Semitic measures. Let me end by going back to what McDonald did not write in his diary on April 8, 1933. The basic thrust of Hitler's comments about Jews. In July 1944, news about the extent of the Holocaust was pouring out. The New York Times, where McDonald had once worked, wrote an editorial entitled, "No Peace with Butchers." This editorial prompted McDonald to write a long letter to the editor about his April 1933 meeting with Hitler. He wrote it from memory, not from his diary. He misdated it as March 31st, 1933. He wrote, "I was given an opportunity to tell Hitler frankly that his anti-Jewish statements and policies were injuring Germany. Immediately, Hitler retorted in words which I shall never forget, 'Even if Germany must draw its belt very much tighter, that will be a small price to pay for ridding itself of the menace of the Jew.'" And then McDonald wrote, "Then he added words which fully disclosed his foul purpose. 'The world will yet thank us for teaching it how to deal with the Jews.'" This was very close to the wording that Stephen Wise, Rabbi Stephen Wise, had recorded McDonald saying at a private meeting in May 1933. And it serves, I think, as McDonald's own confirmation of that source. The New York Times published the letter to the editor under the headline, Hitler Foretold Slaughter. So, the twisted road to Auschwitz. Well, it was twisted in the sense that the Nazi regime from the beginning undertook different initiatives and different directions. It is accurate, and I think a great title. I've told Carl Schleunis that. But MacDonald's diary discloses more of the wishes of Hitler and others close to him. And the road from wish to reality was not nearly so twisted, except in a different sense of the word. There is, in this diary, the briefest reference on November 1st, 1933, to MacDonald's sense that the Nazis considered Jews like cockroaches. One could drive them out, and wherever they went, they would cause problems for others, and that might be to Germany's advantage. But driving them out was not really what the Nazis wanted to do with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Severin, James G. MacDonald in the Vatican, a case study and strategy.
I first of all would like to echo what Richard said about what a great privilege it's been to work with this team, including Benton Arnovitz, who's down there, and how much amazing amounts I've learned by doing this. James G. MacDonald had two basic goals after he spent the spring of 1933 in Germany and witnessed some of the things that Richard was talking about, the persecution of the Jews, the persecution of other people, politicals, and so forth. Even before he became the High Commissioner for Refugees, he was interested in somehow calling the world's attention to what was going on, trying to get some kind of pressure on the Hitler regime in order to get him to stop or at least ameliorate some of what was going on in Germany. He also had another goal, which was to do something about refugees who had left Germany in 1933. In 1933, and were now in nearby countries, living in places like France, and they were in very precarious situation in these countries. In order to do this, he met with a whole bunch of people, including President Roosevelt and Mussolini, and he had four meetings with Cardinal Pacelli. His diary records four meetings with Pacelli, who was the Papal Secretary of State until 1939, when he became Pope Pius XII. These meetings took place between August of 1933 and February of 1935. Actually, in our next volume, he meets again with Pacelli in 1938, around the time of the Evian Conference. The meetings were private. They were arranged by a friend of Pacelli's, an architect in Rome by the name of Galeazzi, Enrico Galeazzi, who sometimes also acted as the go-between between Pacelli and MacDonald. The first meeting took place on August 24th, 1933, 5 weeks after Pacelli had signed the Concordat with Hitler. That took place on July 20th, 1933, and the meeting took place on August 24. The Concordat is a very controversial issue. It provided a legal basis for the German Catholic Church and control over its, that it gave it control over its own ecclesiastical institutions, but it also bound Catholics in Germany to the Nazi state. It required bishops to swear an oath to the Reich. And in its Article 32, it in effect banned Catholic political activity. As in this process, the Catholic Center Party was dissolved. That was one of the things that happened during these negotiations. Now, this Concordat plays an important role. It is the first international treaty that Hitler signed, and what it gave him was a certain legitimacy, I think that's the most important word, and prestige, a certain kind of respectability. And that was important. I should say here that from the moment that it was signed on July 20th, the Concordat was violated by Hitler just about every day. And Pacelli spent a lot of his time in 1933 and 1934 writing protests to the Germans about violations of the Concordat and all sorts of violence that was being carried out against Catholics in various places, especially in Bavaria. So that this Concordat, while it was tenaciously clung to by Pacelli throughout the entire decade, was a tremendous problem for the Roman Catholic Church, and we'll see how that worked out. Now, MacDonald records his conversation with Pacelli on that day. Pacelli gave MacDonald a lesson in realpolitik. He told him that Hitler, he was defending the Concordat, he was being defensive about it, and he told him that Hitler was in power, that he had received a majority in the Reichstag, that the church did not pick and choose the people that it negotiated with, but that it dealt with those in power. Actually, from other documentation, Pacelli was not quite all of this certain about the Concordat at this time. This was in between the signing and the ratification in September, and he apparently vacillated on a number of things, especially this Article 32. And he also told a British envoy to the Vatican something a little bit different than what he told MacDonald. What he gave MacDonald was the formal version. He told the British envoy, among many other things, that a pistol had been put to his head, which is why he signed the Concordat, that in effect he was doing it to save the German Catholic Church, and he even said that he was appalled by the treatment meted out to the Jews, which is something which, as we'll see, he did not say to MacDonald. MacDonald brought up the subject of the Jews, that is, the church's attitude toward the persecution of the Jews in Germany. And this is what MacDonald wrote in his diary about what Pacelli said. Quote, he expressed a feeling of Christian charity, but his reply, both the tone and the contents, convinced me that there could be no help from that quarter, end quote. MacDonald told his associates that he was disappointed by Pacelli's attitude and that the church was much too much on the defensive to do anything about the Jews or to help the Jews in any way. Despite this setback, however, MacDonald didn't give up on Pacelli, but he continued what he called his, quote, flirtation with the Vatican, because he thought that for a number of reasons the Vatican could be important to his mission. And so he tried again, set up another meeting 9 months later, and he began to develop strategies that he thought might work with Pacelli and with his superior, Pope Pius XI. The strategies that he adopted in the next three meetings, and I'm kind of conflating them here, involved stressing the common interests of Jews and Catholics vis-a-vis Nazi Germany. In other words, saying that they were both, they both had a common enemy, emphasizing that not all refugees were Jews, that there were Catholics among them. And finally, and this is the tricky and interesting part, aware of Pacelli's and Pius XI's obsession with leftist persecution of the church in Spain, Mexico, and the Soviet Union, offering to help the church on a quid pro quo basis, in this case in Mexico, as we'll see. In other words, he was going to give Pacelli something in order to get his help. At the next meeting on May 15th, MacDonald noted that Pacelli was friendlier, he was less aloof. He said something interesting at the time. There's nothing new about this, but it's kind of interesting. He told MacDonald that the Nazi leaders, the local regional Nazi leaders, were out of control, and he kind of intimated that Hitler should be tougher with them. It's probably the only time that anybody has ever asked Hitler to be tougher than he really was. And there's a whole story behind this. MacDonald listened to Pacelli describe a book by Alfred Rosenberg. Alfred Rosenberg was a Nazi racist ideologue who was trying to create an alternative religion in which Jesus was an Aryan. And when Pacelli described the book as pagan, and eventually the book was put on the index, MacDonald noted in his reply, I emphasize the community of interest between Jews and Catholics in the face of a common enemy. He chose that moment when he talked about Rosenberg and racism to tell him that Jews and Catholics have a common enemy. And this is the beginning of the use of this strategy. At the November 17th, 1934 meeting, which is the third of the four meetings, MacDonald suddenly stresses Catholic interests entirely to Pacelli. He shows concern about the possibility of Catholic refugees from the Saar following the plebiscite, which is upcoming in January 1935. The Saar is the territory between France and Germany, I think most of you know, and they were having a vote as to where they should go. He mentions Catholic refugees in France and his visit with Cardinal Vergier. There are some Catholic refugees in Paris and in France, and he shows an interest in them. And this is all very true, by the way. MacDonald is not only interested in Jewish refugees. He is interested in all refugees, but he knows that most refugees are Jews. He congratulated Pacelli on his success the previous month, that is October 1934, at the International Eucharistic Congress in Buenos Aires. Now, that was an incredible event. It was staged by the president of Argentina together with Pacelli. There were hundreds of thousands of people celebrating the Eucharist, and Pacelli made a very rare trip to South America. And one of the things he did was to fly around in an airplane over Buenos Aires, which, you know, kind of is interesting. MacDonald mentioned his own upcoming trip to South America and asked for Pacelli's moral support. And he notes in his diary, his reply was all that I could hope for. In other words, now he thinks he's getting somewhere with Pacelli. The last and most interesting interview came 3 months later on January 25th, 1935. MacDonald asked Pacelli to contact government leaders in South America, especially Justo, the president of Argentina, as well as high church officials who might help with the admission of Jewish immigrants. In return, he promised Pacelli that he would use his influence with Jewish leaders in Washington and the United States to help the Catholic Church in Mexico. This is the quid pro quo that I spoke about, which was under, the Catholic Church in Mexico was under considerable pressure from the Mexican government. Actually, this had been going on for years, but there was now a radical new president, Cardenas, and he was a leftist. And Pacelli was very interested in this, and he was, and Galeazzi later told MacDonald that he had actually taken this up with Pius XI, which meant that it was a very important offer that MacDonald made. At the time, by the way, there was a lot of agitation in the United States by American Catholics about the situation in Mexico. The situation basically involved closing schools and persecuting priests and all sorts of attacks on the church. And these ebbed and flowed, and it had been going on for quite a while. At the same time, there was a resolution before the US Senate. There were efforts by the Knights of Columbus to somehow get the United States involved in the Mexican situation. President Roosevelt was more or less neutral. That is, he did not want to interfere in the internal affairs of Mexico. And it might just be, and I'm speculating here, that Pacelli wanted to get MacDonald's help and the Jewish leaders in the United States' help to kind of buttress the American Catholic effort, because Mexico was very important to him and to Pius XI as well. MacDonald went to South America in the spring of 1935. In Richard's conclusion, I think he's described very well what was accomplished or what was not accomplished. He went to Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay with the modest, very modest goal of placing 10,000 or so refugees, about 6,000 in Brazil and maybe 4,000 others in Argentina and Uruguay. Most of these people were German Jews who were professionals and academics, and he was hoping to get them into South America. Now, we don't know whether Pacelli directly intervened or not. I suspect that he did, but I have no proof for it. But MacDonald was very well received by the government leaders and church officials in Argentina and Brazil, by the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, the Cardinal Leme in Rio de Janeiro, as well as the president of Argentina and the up-and-coming dictator of Brazil, Vargas, Getúlio Vargas. However, his mission was not successful, aside from being able to have some German Catholic refugees admitted and a few Jewish professionals. And there are many reasons. The main reason is the political climate in South America, which, by the way, if you read this book, I strongly recommend that section to you. It's kind of unique and very interesting look at South America, admittedly at the elite level, but extremely interesting. He found a very high level of antisemitism and quite a number of anti-Semitic movements in Latin America at this time. We usually don't associate anti-Semitism with Latino countries, and during this period there was quite a bit of this, and MacDonald documents it. And there was a lot of kind of infighting even within the church. For example, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires told MacDonald that Jews were welcome in Argentina and received him very well. At the very same time, the newspaper of the main Catholic newspaper in Buenos Aires, Criterio, said exactly the opposite. The Jews were not welcome. So you had the fear of Jewish connections to the left and to leftist radicalism. The economic conditions had something to do with it. There was a desire for farmers and immigrants. These Latin American countries wanted farmers and immigrants. This was true of most of them. I mean, in Bolivia, it was the case as well. And obviously, these people were not farmers. These German Jews were not farmers or immigrants. I should note here that one historian of Brazil, Jeffrey Lesser, does credit MacDonald, while he had no short-term success, for laying the groundwork for later refugee admissions to Brazil later in the decade. And by using the tactic of stressing the desirability of Jewish immigrants to the economies of these countries and their usefulness in many ways in a number of areas. And Lesser thinks that this kind of took with the elite that McDonald was speaking to. Finally, instead of a conclusion, I really have no conclusion, because you have to be very tentative with this kind of material, and we don't have Pacelli's side of these conversations. And so in lieu of a conclusion, to me, when I read this, Pacelli, the Pacelli of 1933 to 35, comes across in ways with which I think we're familiar a bit later on. He is guarded, secretive, cautious. He appears, however, quite worldly. There is not a single spiritual or religious word passed between McDonald and Pacelli during these interviews. A skilled diplomat who, above all else, guards his privacy. He tells McDonald that these are private interviews, and he's not given to making public pronouncements of any kind. He is, however, as we've seen, willing to deal, to make a deal, when church interests, or he apparently is willing to make a deal, when church interests are at stake. I stress the importance of the Concordat. The Concordat is mentioned three times. It appears to influence Vatican policy in many ways, especially with regard to the persecution of the Jews. Pacelli is getting messages from Cardinal Faulhaber in Munich and from other German Catholic clerics, kind of panicking at the idea of saying anything about the Jews. He does privately once or twice during this period, but there is this fear, and the fear somehow, which is compulsive, is about the Concordat. But no matter how many times Hitler violates the Concordat, Pacelli is dedicated to it. He thinks it is saving the church in Germany, that it provides the only legal basis for the survival of the church, and therefore this has tremendous application in many other areas, because they're afraid to do anything because they're afraid that somehow the relationship with Hitler is going to blow up and the Concordat will be gone, and that affects many different areas. Finally, McDonald demonstrates great diplomatic skill of his own. He has very few cards and very few illusions in this time. But given the political climate and the prevailing attitude towards Jews and towards refugees, but he plays his cards well, he's persistent, and he does his best, for he sensed that the stakes are very high indeed.
Thank you, Severin. Bobby, reflections on the righteous, personal characteristics of James Grover McDonald as evidenced in his diaries.
Who was this man, James G. McDonald? Where did he come from? What made him the man he was? Why did he care so much about his fellow man? Why did he want to help Jews? I don't know all the answers, but I'll try briefly to tell you something of his life before we join him in the diaries of 1932. But first, I must confess that as his daughter, I'm completely biased. I adored him, so you've been forewarned. In many ways, McDonald was a typical American, born of immigrant parents. His father came from Canada, his mother was born of German immigrants. And in later years, he often said, in answer to those who were afraid of letting in refugees, that immigration had built America, and that if it weren't for his father's immigrating, he wouldn't be there. Typically American also was his birth and upbringing in a small town in western Ohio, and then in Albany, Indiana, where his father ran a small hotel of maybe 20 rooms. He was the third of five brothers and called by his middle name Grover. He'd been named after Grover Cleveland, who was the president when he was born in 1886. My father used to say that he'd been born a Democrat and never recovered. I can only guess what my father's life was like growing up. we never talked about it, or he never talked about it, and unfortunately, I guess I never asked. Only two stories have come down. One, that when his curls were cut off, he was about 4 or 5, and obviously his mother had wanted a girl. He ran away from home and stole a banana at a railroad station. Well, I can't vouch for the truth of all of the story, but the curls were for real. And you can see them on the screen. The other story is that they had a chorus in the high school and threw out the only boy who could sing. Indeed, I never did hear my father sing. In Albany, he met Ruth Stafford, who lived with her family just a block away from the hotel. In due course, they were engaged for 7 years. One of the obstacles to the course of true love was that Grover was a Roman Catholic, and Ruth was brought up a strict Methodist with a very strong prejudice against Catholicism. According to family lore, on Wednesday evenings, when Ruth's mother and father would go to midweek prayer meeting, she went to see Grover at the hotel. And near closing time for the meeting, Grover's youngest brother was sent out to the corner to watch for people coming out of the meeting so that Ruth could make it home before her parents. The engagement may also have lasted so long because the McDonald family moved to Bloomington, Indiana, so that the boys could go to the university. The oldest had already left to work as a telegraph operator, but the other four all lived at home, waited table, all graduated from Indiana University, three of them becoming professors. Grover worked as an instructor while getting his master's in political science and history and continued at Harvard working for his PhD. From there, he received a fellowship to do research for his dissertation for 6 months in Spain. Unfortunately, the dissertation was on an obscure order of Spanish monks, in whom Grover gradually realized neither he nor anyone else was interested. However, the trip to Spain turned out to be the perfect opportunity for a honeymoon. Ruth and Grover were finally married on August 25th, 1915, first by a Catholic priest with the McDonald family in Bloomington, and then later that day by a Methodist minister in Albany with the Stafford family and their friends. Since World War I had just started and there were U-boats in the Atlantic, after the celebration, Ruth's father took Grover aside and said, "If anything happens to Ruth, be sure to send back the body." Fortunately, the newlyweds encountered no U-boats and had a wonderful time on their first taste of European travel. Grover returned to teaching at Indiana, and while he was there, he wrote a pamphlet which became significant later in his relations with the Nazis. It was entitled "German Atrocities and International Law," in which he argued that the German invasion of Belgium was justified on the basis of self-preservation. However, as the war progressed, he became a strong advocate for America joining the Allies. In 1917, a baby daughter, Janet, was born, and with a growing family, Grover asked for a raise, but was told that the university finances would not permit it. So he looked for another job and was offered one with the Civil Service Reform League. The family came to New York City in the fall of 1918. But in January of 1919, McDonald accepted the post of chairman of the League of Free Nations Association, which later changed its name to the Foreign Policy Association, as it broadened its focus beyond the U.S. participation in the League of Nations to studies of international problems and America's role therein. McDonald stayed with the FPA, as it was called, until he resigned in 1933 to become High Commissioner. These 15 years were critical in the formation of McDonald's interests. Intellectually, they broadened his horizons. The FPA did studies, published a headline series, held luncheons with outstanding speakers such as Ramsay MacDonald and Franklin Roosevelt, pioneered in radio broadcasting, both the Saturday luncheons, but also a weekly 15-minute broadcast on international relations. As branches of the FPA were established throughout the country, he traveled to speak at their meetings. And each summer, he traveled abroad to interview presidents and prime ministers and to attend the League of Nations General Assembly meeting in September. At home, he met with Hoover and Coolidge on issues such as the World Court and Secretary of State Simpson on the Manchurian crisis. The FPA depended on private funding and was supported by many who wanted the U.S. to be involved in the world and to counteract the isolationist thinking of the times. One of MacDonald's main jobs was fundraising, something that he would spend the rest of his life doing. In this, he became acquainted with the wealthy like-minded, both Jews and Gentiles, Felix Warburg and John D. Rockefeller II. The latter was the largest single contributor to the FPA in its early days. Henry Morgenthau Sr. and John Foster Dulles, among others. MacDonald also learned to deal with women. He could charm them, but he came to appreciate and admire their capabilities and accomplishments. The FPA staff itself was almost wholly made up of women, and the most active members of the board were women. He became friends with Carrie Chapman Catt, Lillian Wald, Eleanor Roosevelt, Dorothy Strait. Their interest in the human side of problems, the importance of family, the influence of great policy decisions on the individual must have impressed him. I think both my sister and I always felt that we were equal to any sons, and we were encouraged to pursue any career we wanted. My father admired people because of what they did or stood for, irrespective of their sex, religion, or color. Perhaps one of MacDonald's greatest gifts was his ability to listen to people. To get people to talk about themselves and what interested them. His amazing memory enabled him to dictate almost verbatim what he heard the next day or several days later. And it was in his diary that he reported all these interviews and conversations. The diary starts in 1922 and continues through the years of the FPA. But in 1932 that it begins to focus on Hitler and the problem of the refugees. And that's where we start Advocate for the Doomed. His lifelong interest in Germany, his advocacy of the League of Nations, his concern for those fleeing Hitler's rule, and his growing conviction that there's no future for the Jews in Germany, made him devote his life first to establishing the High Commission for Refugees, and then taking over the job of trying to make it work. As you can see, when, or if you read the diaries, MacDonald gave himself totally to his mission of helping refugees find homes, raising money for their support and trying to persuade governments to open their doors or at least be more lenient in the documents required, and getting Germany to allow refugees to take out more of their property. Many refugees did find homes. Money was raised. But despite the efforts of many men and women of goodwill, the magazine The Nation was probably right in calling the High Commission a noble failure. In later years, when most historians had forgotten about the existence of the High Commission, one suggested that perhaps a more internationally renowned figure or one with a more driving personality could have accomplished more. I doubt it, but then I warn you, I'm prejudiced. It seemed absolutely clear to me, as it was to MacDonald from the beginning, that there was no way Hitler was going to change his attitude toward the Jews. In addition, the current economic situation precluded putting out the welcome mat, as did the overwhelming anti-immigrant sentiment, even supposing some of the governments were sympathetic. The High Commission had been given an impossible task, as MacDonald recognized in his letter of resignation, with its indictment of Hitler and of the failure of the rest of the world to deal with the menace that Hitler represented. Despite the obstacles he faced and the tragedies he saw, my father never lost his faith in human beings. He worked with many people who spent their lives helping others, and this diary is in many ways a tribute to them. As an educator, and essentially that's what he was, he believed that people could learn and change and make the world better. It certainly was worth trying. After the High Commission, he had the opportunity to continue to educate, first as a member of the editorial board of the New York Times and later as a radio commentator on international affairs. If I were to choose one thing I might call my father's greatest gift to me, I think it would be a love of life and of all that it offers. I think this attitude toward life comes out in the diaries, cutting through the heaviness of daily problems. He loved music, and whenever there was a free evening, he escaped to a concert or theater or movie. He loved books and was always interested in what I was reading, would pick it up and read chapters so that we could discuss it. Whenever possible, he visited the great galleries of Europe for an hour of refreshment. On board ship, he loved to dance and play deck tennis. If there were ever time, and there was rarely during the High Commission days, his favorite escape was a round of golf. He loved talking to people, listening to them, and learning. My father was also interested in religion. I couldn't describe his faith. We never discussed it. After marrying out of the Catholic Church, he never attended Mass. He went regularly to church with the family, but the specific denomination of Protestant church largely depended on the preacher. His favorite was Harry Emerson Fosdick of Riverside Church in New York City, a progressive liberal thinker. I think the ethical and intellectual aspects of religion were what he really was concerned with. And in later years, he found the study of Orthodox Judaism a new challenge. He felt very strongly the obligation of Christians to help others, particularly refugees created by Christian prejudice. He stated repeatedly that anti-Semitism stemmed from the failure of nominal Christians to behave like true Christians. Despite times of discouragement and disaster in the next 10 years, MacDonald never gave up. He continued to do whatever he could to help. After the Avignon Conference in 1938, became chairman of President Roosevelt's Advisory Committee on Refugees. In that role, he worked with those who struggled to rescue the remnants. These years will be covered in Volume 2, which is already in progress. Over the years, MacDonald became more and more convinced that Palestine was the greatest hope for the Jews of Germany and the dispossessed of Eastern Europe. He saw with great satisfaction the UN partition of Palestine and the proclamation of the State of Israel in 1948. And it was like a fulfillment of a dream that he was appointed the first US representative to Israel and subsequent first ambassador. As Stephen mentioned, I was fortunate to be able to go with him as his hostess until my mother came, and then live in the state for a year and a half. It was my father's hope that Jews and Arabs, who had so much to offer each other, could someday live together in peace. But he was realistic enough to know it would take many years. He spoke of 25. Alas, that was not to be. His diaries of the first years of Israel will make up Volume 3. And my wish is that we will all be here someday to celebrate that publication.
Thank you, Bobby. And I believe we have time for Q&A.
I guess I'll...
You can start.
I'll start. I think one gets from this diary a fairly good picture of individual personalities at the elite level. MacDonald went from country to country and from meeting to meeting and did not spend a great deal of time sort of mingling with the average person in the street. So if you're looking for a source to kind of figure out what was the German public like in the mid-1930s, this is probably not the best source for it. But you really do get a very good picture of key individuals in Germany and I should say also in a number of other countries, personalities of Jewish leaders in different countries, a lot of elite personalities. What role did personalities in Germany have in the Holocaust? Well, the Hitler who appears in these pages is, and I'm alluding very briefly and passingly to old historiographical controversies. The Hitler who appears here is a very strong, fixed person and very much an influence on people around him and others in the party and government. MacDonald sometimes said that talking to other Nazis was a little bit like hearing somebody recite lessons out of the catechism, because there was an official view that they had absorbed and they truly believed in, and they just weren't going to go outside of that. So personality at the top was very important here. And other personalities, he noticed differences between those who were truly committed to Nazi ideology and the Nazi regime and those who were not. And he had a very astute sense of, well, there's a struggle for power here within the German Foreign Office between Nazi elements and non-Nazi elements. And he had a sense that the Nazi elements would ultimately win out. So he saw sort of people operating at the ideological level and at the personal level, and it comes across very well in this book. It is really, in spite of its size, a great read.
Sever and Bobby, do you care to add anything?
Did you?
You threw me. That's a very tough one in terms of the book, and it's a very tough question. And, you know, what historical biography is about and how much of that is important. I'm a big believer in the influence of personality, although I think that in this case, in Pacelli and Pius XI, you have the intersection of personality and system as well. You know, you cannot say that the system here, that the traditions of the Catholic Church and of the Vatican and of the Curia are not important. They're terribly important. But would things have been exactly the same without the specific personality of Pacelli and of Pius XI? Probably not. So.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Donald Hunter. I'm an independent Harvard scholar. I have two questions. Where is Mr. MacDonald buried? And two, after Pope Pius XI died, were the Catholic German cardinals allowed to go to Rome to elect a new pope? And was Cardinal Bocelli elected as Pope Pius XII on the first ballot?
You asked where was MacDonald buried?
Yes.
In Albany, Indiana.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, both he and his wife, and there's a family, little family cemetery.
Suzanne can back me up on this one, but I believe that the German cardinals were allowed to go to Rome. That I'm pretty certain about. What's the other question? I'm sorry.
Was he elected as the first ballot as the new pope?
I have no idea.
I have a vague recollection that it was not on the first ballot.
Hi, I'm Ben Harnovitz. We all know that books are published really to disseminate knowledge, and in this case, there's a lot of archival material behind this. And as Richard mentioned, this book is not a small book. Books tend to be perceived as a discretionary acquisition these days, and I wonder if all of you, and particularly Richard, can shed some light on why this is a more imperative acquisition. Perhaps a summary listing of some of the sort of categories of disclosure that one finds in the book. Maybe some parallels between some Herman Wouk's book on the Winds of War and characters in that. Perhaps something about his relationship with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. We've already heard a bit about the disclosures Latin American refuge, but I wonder if there's anything to be said, particularly in light of the recent popularity of Michael Chambon's book about a fictional refuge in Alaska. And finally, I think maybe a picture of what MacDonald's testimony reveals about the perceptions of the threat and the reactions of both non-Jewish leadership and Jewish leadership at the time, and also of level of anti-Semitism in America at that time.
You take all of that, Richard.
How long have I got? An hour? I don't want to sort of go bullet point by bullet point into disclosures. I will say that there's a lot of material in this book that appears absolutely nowhere else. The material that I've used about Hitler, the material that Severin's used about Cardinal Bocelli, of course, the personal information about MacDonald, you're not going to find anywhere else. You can look at the most detailed biography of Hitler. Ian Kershaw's two-volume work is the one I'm thinking of. Maybe there's something since then, but that's a very good one. There's nothing about a meeting of Adolf Hitler and James J. MacDonald in April 1933. This is just a lot of it, totally new information. In addition, some of this is not quite as exciting, but there's an awful lot of information about European diplomacy and the League of Nations in the early 1930s. MacDonald was able to talk to the heads of state in a wide range of countries, and he got their sense of where were the threats to peace and what was likely to happen. And you can sort of see things deteriorate day by day as Europe lurches from one crisis to another. With regard to the United States, I haven't said too much. My focus was elsewhere, and also I'm supposed to be giving a presentation at the Roosevelt Library in about a week, where I will focus on disclosures about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. There is also, with regard to the Roosevelts, material that cannot be found anywhere else. And in fact, MacDonald, again, because he listened well, and because he had interesting things to say, was able to get President Roosevelt, in one case in a late night conversation because McDonald was staying over at the White House, to sort of give his views of the world in 1933 and talk about where there were real serious threats of war and what his sense of Nazi Germany was like. I've done months of research at the Roosevelt Library and years of research at the National Archives, and one just doesn't find the kind of frank material that is in this diary. Very briefly on the Roosevelts, I think McDonald in this period liked both of them a great deal. He was politically closer to Eleanor Roosevelt than to Franklin Roosevelt. She was more firmly committed to ideas that he was committed to. Franklin Roosevelt comes across okay in this diary, in this period, but his behavior was guided by what he thought he could do in particular situations, and that was often less than McDonald wanted him to do.
Just one quick comment. Richard, I think, has covered a lot of it. You asked about the Jewish elites, or at least the Jewish elites that McDonald dealt with. I think this is one of the finest diaries, one of the best works in terms of learning about the Jewish elites, not only in the United States, but also Jewish elites among the Zionists in Palestine, the Jewish elites especially in Britain and France, and also in Germany. And what this reveals, I think, is absolutely priceless in many ways, and you cannot get it anyplace else. A lot of it is very disappointing. Some of it is inspiring, but I think it's one of the finest looks at the Jewish elite world, but not only the elite world. There are trade union people. There are people who are, you know, lower down on the social scale. Rabbis. I mean, there are meetings that I don't think anybody ever knew with Jabotinsky, who is the leader of the revisionist Zionists. McDonald meets him in Warsaw in 1934 and has a fascinating exchange and is very admiring of him, although not necessarily of his politics at that point, but of the man. And then they meet again in 1940 in New York and things of that nature. So that part is very valuable.
If I could just add briefly, the diary does have a great deal of historical material that hasn't been revealed up until now. However, I have the advantage of not being a historian, so I can say from a non-historian standpoint, it is still an extraordinarily exciting and compelling read. For us those of us who are not historians, McDonald does give us character sketches many times. He doesn't simply tell the historical events that are happening, and sometimes he gives his commentary and take. One of the ones that struck me in particular was just before Roosevelt becomes president of the United States. I believe it's around 32 or so, and it's clear that Roosevelt is going to be elected in. McDonald is returned from Germany, and Roosevelt invites him to Hyde Park to get McDonald's view on what is Germany like, and can we deal with these people, and what have you. And he quite literally paints a picture for us of Roosevelt sitting on this edge of his desk with his two little legs dangling over the side and talking to him and arguing with him, and also him leaving that meeting, going all the way down, driving down the driveway of Hyde Park, where he ran into Mrs. Roosevelt, not Eleanor, but Franklin's mother, who pointed at him to get his car in reverse because she refused to yield, and McDonald having to go in reverse up the considerable driveway of Hyde Park so that she could park her car in front of her house. So it is, in many ways, a very funny read at times as well.
I guess if I want to sum up in answer to Benton's question, what this book tells is a sort of answer to the perennial question, why didn't the world do something? It's all about why the world didn't do something in the sense that McDonald was trying to do something, and it reveals all of the people who refused to help or could not help or tried to help, but it didn't work. It reveals all of the obstacles.
I am Robert Ehrenreich of the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies. First of all, I'd like to thank all of the speakers for the wonderful presentations that you made. I would like to ask Professor McDonald Stewart, the story that you tell about him, I mean, you could see where he could have become a very cynical person after 35 and so forth. What was he like at that point? And also, towards later in life, when he was looking back at everything he did, how did he approach, what did he remember about this?
I don't think he was ever cynical. He was certainly very discouraged during the war, and he had a big map in his study with pins with colored heads on them, and used to move them every day as to where the battle lines were in the different sectors. And it was a very uncomfortable position being proved right. But I think he, as I say, fundamentally was not a discouraged person, and I don't think he ever really became cynical about people. And even afterward, later on, as I say, his real revival of hope was Israel and what it offered as a potential for the ingathering of the Jews, and the, he kept trying to, in his early days there, to try to see that there, where there were ways that the Arabs and Jews could work together rather than on a confrontational basis. And after, even after he left there, his interest for many years was in raising bonds for money for Israel, because he did think this was the hope and what was important in the Middle East, that it could be the beacon of democracy in the Middle East. And so I don't, and because I think he was interested in so many things in life, whether it was art or music or books, he couldn't become totally absorbed in politics, and even though the awful things that were happening in the world. So I don't think he ever was really cynical.
My name is Stephen Shore. I have two brief questions. Whenever a material of this sort that comes forth, encyclopedic, hitherto unknown, with a character's interactions with a variety of key figures from a specific period, you basically can use it to supplement or round out the impressions you already have of historical figures, or in some cases radically revise them. And I'm wondering, based on this book, which prominent figures will have their reputations radically revised rather than simply supplemented? My second question is, given this being this interaction in this specific period, it would seem there would be two basic approaches. One could use political means or advocate a military means to prevent a potential refugee problem, or accept that one country would force out a substantial portion of its population, and that therefore the other nations must should or ought to find a means to receive the refugees. So given what these two approaches, which what dominated Mr. McDonald's efforts in this period?
Radically revise opinions? Well, I suppose it depends what opinions you cite as the received view. I mean, if you believe that Adolf Hitler was a very strong dictator and had a fixed ideology which was absolutely influential in shaping Nazi policies, then it's simply going to supplement. But if you believe that Adolf Hitler was a weak dictator and that the Nazis really didn't know what to do with the Jews, then it will radically revise them, or at least I would argue that it should. Again, with Franklin Roosevelt, you know, Roosevelt has been described as everything from a villain of the Holocaust to the savior of the Jews. Well, the picture here is in between, and it's fairly nuanced in between. I'm not going to get in detail into matters covered in volume two, but as the situation changed, Roosevelt changed. And there are, from a humanitarian perspective, there are high points and low points. And I think that, you know, with Adolf Hitler, you look at his character, you look at his attitudes, and you have an explanation for his behavior and those that he controlled. With Franklin Roosevelt, I think it's probably a mistake to try to explain everything from character or lack of character. I think he had certain humanitarian instincts, but he was a consummate politician guided by what he thought he could accomplish and what were the trade-offs in individual situations. And I think this book helps one to appreciate the kind of political calculus that Roosevelt went through when he was asked to do something. And the second volume will show that, I think, even better. So it will, I think, change things in the sense of rejecting the two extremes and showing Roosevelt operating in the middle. Pacelli, I think we're talking about supplementing the received view. Of course, we would all like to have access to Vatican archives, which would help us to show whether Pacelli, in fact, did assist MacDonald in his 1935 trip to South America or did not. That would certainly show something. With regard to kind of political military strategy, well, this book is good because it really gives one a sense of what the world was like in the 1930s. And in some ways, it's very reminiscent. I mean, there were lots of troubles, in fact, worse troubles than we have. But in some ways, it was a very different world. You know, the United States is the most powerful country in the world today. In the 1930s, in the mid-1930s, Germany was probably the most powerful country in the world, not the United States. The United States had a smaller army than Belgium did and was in no position in the midst of a depression that was the worst crisis in our history, a social and political crisis as well as an economic crisis, in no position to think about any kind of military intervention. And so, you know, MacDonald's hope was not to mobilize a single country to do something about Germany, but rather that the League of Nations collectively, if you got all of a bunch of democratic nations together, you might be able to do something. And he was terribly disappointed in what he saw in the League of Nations. So there wasn't really a big strategy that would cure the situation. The only thing you could try to do was to develop a strategy to mitigate the situation, and his strategy there was, if the Nazi regime was willing to or said it wanted to get rid of Jews, let's let most of them go out and find places where they could go, and then Nazi Germany should stop persecuting the rest of them. That didn't work, but it was certainly worth trying.
My name is Jürgen Matthäus. I'm an historian here at the museum. My question basically ties in with what Richard just described. Obviously, James MacDonald was a very good observer of what was going on in Germany. He spoke to those who were involved in, if not in charge of, anti-Jewish policy in Germany early on. And he talked to others all across the world, and specifically in America. Why do you think the message didn't get through? If indeed he was convinced, and I think there is no reason to doubt, that this is what Hitler was out for. Was there conflicting information? I think based on his strong personality and his experience, he was clearly able to make a strong point. So what were the forces against him at the time?
You can choose one of 150, Jürgen. The forces against
him. Speak louder.
The forces against him. First of all, there is one thing that this kind of documents very well, which is that nobody really believed that Hitler was a permanent situation. In other words, they believed that he was going to be overthrown somehow, that he was a temporary phenomenon, that the Reichswehr was going to get rid of him, that the socialists were going to get rid of him, that there was going to be a communist revolution or whatever. It took a while before people realized that this is something that's going to be around for a while. And I would say that's a major factor. There are many others. The economic crisis at the time, the kind of attitudes towards Jews. For example, Benton asked about the United States. I don't think that there was nearly as much anti-Semitism. I'm not sure how you gauge this, but just impressionistically, I don't think there was as much anti-Semitism in the United States as there was in Europe, and yet this is pretty much the peak period of American anti-Semitism, I would say, going into toward the late 30s. So you have this attitude towards Jews, and I think this is documented very well here. Among the elites, and I'm sure to some extent among ordinary people, about somehow there is something that the Jews are doing that is causing all of this. You have a lot of that kind of reaction. There is the general removal of countries like the United States from the European scene. It's just endless. He was in a situation where it was very difficult to believe that the things that he was saying were going to be as bad as he portrayed them. He had this unique sense. I mean, there were some other people who had a unique sense that there was a catastrophe about to happen. And many people just did not have that sense, including the Jewish leadership, much of the Jewish leadership in the United States. McDonald harangued them again and again. He said, folks, take this seriously. You know, this is serious, what's happening to the German Jews. And some took it seriously, many did not.
I think it's also sort of a normal reaction of, I don't want to believe it, I won't believe it, intellectually I may believe it, but I can't accept it, and so what can I really do about it anyway? So you sort of, it's wishful thinking, which sort of overcomes a lot of reality.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much.